Welcome to the Smart Thinking Podcast. This is my dad, Ted.
Welcome to the Smart Thinking Podcast. I'm your host, Ted Knightsky. Well, how about joining me for an interview and conversation with Heather Staker, a nationally recognized blended learning expert, author, and idea trendsetter. We have a great conversation here about how we need to mind the gaps for kids, meet the needs of the students at where they're at, make sure that we're focusing on relationships in the blended learning environment, and more importantly, her newest work on flex models of learning. And learn from Heather and her expertise and all of the different ideas and innovations she's bringing to the blended learning spaces.
Welcome to the Smart Thinking Podcast. Today I've got Heather Staker with me, who is an author and a recognized expert on blended learning strategies. And we are bringing you this conversation today to help you immediately in your classrooms and your schools so that you can start to pivot and grow in your ability to provide methods for kids that are both engaging and support their learning, which is the single most important thing that we have. So Heather, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Ted.
So I wanted to start out with, tell us a little bit about your personal educational journey before we get into the strategies to help kids. So where did you grow up and where did you go to school and stuff like that?
Sure. So I grew up in Irvine, California. I was the second of seven children. So I was from a big family in Southern California. I was raised near the beach and went to public school for my entire life. My senior year of high school, I was appointed by the governor of the state of California to be the student member on the State Board of Education. So there's one member of the State Board of Education of the 11 members that has full voting privileges. And so I spent about a week of each month, my junior year, living in a Hyatt hotel by myself in Sacramento, voting on the State Board of Education, and then flew home. I was the student body president of my high school, and so managed that interesting lifestyle of trying to be very involved in high school and at the same time spent a quarter of my time in Sacramento voting on policy. And that experience acquainted me at an early age to what it's like to govern and set policy in education. And mostly what it did was give me an appetite for innovation. I just thought, how do we solve some of these problems? I had the opportunity to visit juvenile detention centers and private schools and public schools and charter schools and schools all over the state of California. And I just saw so many children who were suffering was really what I felt. And I just thought at an early age, I want to help fix this system. And that was as a 17-year-old. And I have to say that surprisingly now, decades later, I feel like I've pretty much remained true to that sense of calling that I experienced as a teenager.
That is pretty amazing. So who was governor then?
Pete Wilson.
And all right, so I'm a social studies teacher. And like you, I was involved. I was elected in school. I actually was an alderman, stuff like that. I've been fascinated with it. And I get, like, as you probably still are, I get called to a lot of different service at the state and policy level. You got to tell me what that's like to be a 17-year-old hanging out in Sacramento. How comfortable at that age were you engaging these probably a lot of gray-haired, gray-suited men who were superintendents of big systems? What was that like?
I was surprised by how contentious it was. This was back in 1993, 94, when there was a big movement for school choice. Mm-hmm. And so often the media wanted the student voice on some of these issues. So my parents ended up getting a personal landline for me just so that I could field the number of media calls that I got. And then every month prior to a state board meeting, I was shipped four or five really big banker boxes full of documents. So curriculum frameworks and other materials that I was supposed to review prior to these meetings. And I just remember in between meetings in Sacramento, using one of the receptionist's fax machines to send my essays and assignments back to my teachers so that I wouldn't fail my classes while I was trying to manage that. But it really was more research and content than a 17-year-old or really even an adult, I would imagine, could responsibly be competent in mastering each month. And so I felt like, and combined with the fact that the student term is 1 year and the other adults had 4-year terms. And so I was at a disadvantage, and I learned who my allies were on the state board and learned to vote with them and then speak up when I felt like I had something of value to share. But I will say that what it gave me was exposure that then I think I've been able to use now to go back and contribute in a way that I could have, wish I could have contributed as well back then.
Yeah. And then my other question for you is, I have been to your neck of the woods in Southern California a few times. Did you, so I was Dana Point High School, which I think, is that south of Irving?
A little
that,
bit south.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was out for a run one morning and all of a sudden I saw all these kids come off a bus with surfboards and they had surfing for Phi Ed. Now I live in Wisconsin, so that's not going to happen here. And I thought everything about Southern California is as cool as it looks. Did you have Phi Ed at the beach like they did?
Well, now I live in Texas, and I will say that I feel like the emphasis that they put on the football team here is more akin to the emphasis that they put on the water polo team in Southern California. So it is funny how sports vary from place to place.
So tell us about your journey then. So you had those really cool developmental opportunities in high school. Where did you go from high school?
So from there, I went to Harvard College and majored in government, really focused again on thinking. I was so ensconced in like public policy at that point that it was really where my passion was. And then attended Harvard Business School and got an MBA, thinking that if I had those administration type skills, that it would inform my ability to be a good innovator in education. So I really did feel like that interest in education continued. I spent some years in the private sector and in corporate jobs, mostly to pay the bills, and then ended up not very long thereafter actually having children of my own. And that's what brought me back into schooling as I started teaching kindergarten, teaching preschool and really working intimately with my own children. I was absorbed back into education again and eventually took a job with the Clayton Christensen Institute for Disruptive Innovation that focuses on how do we use innovation theories that have helped Fortune 500 companies be successful? How do we apply those in the social sector? So in healthcare and education, to create movement in those worlds and solve some of the vexing problems in those worlds. And so that was a fruitful and really wonderful experience to join the Christensen Institute and be able to work with that think tank to study and research and propose ways to innovate more successfully in K-12 schools.
That is fantastic. And when you reflect back on the qualities of the teachers you had in your formative years of, you know, kindergarten up through 12th grade, what were some of the qualities that endeared you to teachers that got you to really be your best?
Well, the woman that I'll never forget, it was my preschool teacher named Joan Trexler. When I was in preschool and kindergarten, I had a horrible speech impediment, the type where they actually decided that I should be sent to a school for the mentally I don't even remember the word. It was not a politically correct word that they used back in those days for those who were mentally disabled or something, because I had such a hard time with any speech production. And so the Joan Trexler met with me several times a week, and we drilled every sound trying to teach me how to be able to talk. And she changed my life. She taught me how to talk. And I think she opened the world to me. And the thing that she did that was remarkable to me was that she recognized that I had some gifts, even though I wasn't able to speak. And she told my mother that, even though I was in a school that was labeled a school for those who had mental handicaps, she told my mother that I had some gifts. And I just honor her. And, you know, interestingly, my daughter was recently accepted into the Gifted and Talented program. And I'm so ambivalent about that because I don't believe there's one set of parameters around what gifted and talented means. I think every single human has genius and has something to contribute and has a calling on this world, and that we've got to retire this idea that some children have special needs and some children are gifted and talented. It's just not true. Every single child has gifts and has areas of weakness, and it's just so time to retire some of those labels.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, because, you know, having been, a teacher and then a principal and a superintendent and being around thousands of kids over the course of my career, I have yet to meet someone who doesn't have some ability to change the direction of other people, which is truly what makes people heroic and gifted, not our ability to repeat, content or, kind of spit things out. Now, granted, there's room under the tent for true gifts of, artistic pieces. And there are people who just have talents that way. But to your point, there is no one who doesn't have those things. So with that in mind and those qualities, and well, I've got to back up. Have you told Mrs. Trexler or spoken to her? Or
I have never, if she's listening to this now, thank you, Joan Trexler. I would love to find her. I should look her up.
I think you should, because that is what fuels us in education. Is you can have 160 bad moments in a row, because we don't have bad days. Smart thinkers don't have bad days. We only have bad moments. And then you could have one person reach out to you and say, hey, in 1999, you told me that there was nothing stopping me from being great. And I took that seriously, and it changed my day and it changed my life. And Ms. Trexler obviously did that for you. So We'll send the smart thinking team after Ms. Trexler.
Thank you. And what a great point, though. Like, just taking those moments to acknowledge. It's the idea of look for the helpers. And it's an important one this moment, as the world has a lot of issues it's dealing with. There are some real heroes, too.
Well, most educators that I know are humble, and they are highly motivated intrinsically. But they are also perfectionists, and they want to do a really, really good job. And Heather, that's why we had you come on the podcast today, because as the entire country is flipping to multiple modalities of learning and teaching, we are not all designed for that. Now, I graduated from college in the early 90s, and I'm a history major, and I have a teaching degree, but not one time in my formative years of becoming a teacher or a graduate school or postgraduate school did I ever learn methods for instruction and learning in a virtual environment or in a blended environment. So what tips do you have for, just starting with basic design of, creating a good lesson, a good opportunity to have those blended opportunities for kids and teachers?
Well, let me just say as a preamble that there is an opportunity right now for teachers and for school leaders to make some important instructional shifts. Thomas Arnett at the Christensen Institute led some important research where he found that one of the key things that causes important shifts in and changes in schools is that teachers find that their existing instructional models aren't relevant for the problems at hand. So we're at a big moment of change right now, and it's partly because existing teachers think the way I've been doing it isn't exactly right anymore. And so how do we get going on some new models? The first thing to recognize is that if we're going to start using technology to reach learners and to give students a way to work remotely, we have to mine the gaps. We need to look for where students aren't going to be able to get on that train and make sure that their needs are met. And so that's just the precursor from a matter of an equitable chance for learners, is to assess individual student needs and identify which students don't have the Maslow hierarchy in place that will allow them to get on the train. And that's a cooperative effort between teachers and school leaders. Teachers are absolutely the best positioned to be able to assess where individual learners are. And I would recommend literally getting out a spreadsheet or some kind of a tracker and listing the members of your class, and then identifying, do they have their basic physiological needs met? Do they have their basic safety needs met, including custodial care, someone to care for them during the day if they're not learning at a brick and mortar facility right now? And then do they have some of their social and emotional needs met? And then you can start thinking about their academic needs. Do they have a device? Do they have the internet? After that type of data is collected, then it's a team effort with the administration to identify who can help solve which gaps? That's where the teacher can't do it. And the leaders need to step in and create systemic resolutions to some of the gaps that are emerging for their students.
So we just had about a month ago, a neuroscientist on, Jared Horvath or Dr. Horvath from, who went to Harvard to probably about the same time you were there. He's in Australia at Melbourne. And he had said the exact same thing, that the brain needs to be safe so that the body can make its motions. And that's a really, really good point. So do you have any tips or like methods for that check-in at the start of the lesson, the unit, the interaction that you would suggest to teachers and staff?
Well, one way that teachers can stay close to where their learners are is by ensuring that in their weekly schedule, they're doing one-on-one check-ins. What I saw at the beginning of the pandemic was teachers who were using Zoom or video conferencing wanted to use that whole class time to try to check in with the students. And so oftentimes I saw teachers going round robin style and saying, all right, Tommy, how are you doing? Susie, how are you doing? And it's a really ineffective use of the time. And it's pointless in terms of being able to actually understand what's truly genuinely happening with your learners. Now, the complexity here is that teachers don't have the time or the bandwidth to be able to do one-on-one check-ins unless a few other things change in their practice. So in order to get to the point where teachers have a realistic way of repurposing their time for those crucial one-on-one check-ins that not only help them diagnose where students are academically, but also diagnose where they are socially and emotionally and in terms of the other needs that they have in their lives. One of the prerequisites or precursors for teachers is to set up what I call a blended learning arc, where it's really composed of a few main things. One is group discussion. So you'll want to gather your learners together at the beginning of the day or beginning of the week and have a discussion that launches them into the week. And that can be something that connects them together with a simple question as, do you prefer cats or dogs? I mean, honestly, any kind of a question that's open-ended and allows them to engage. Your dog. We have two ferrets right now and a bearded dragon. So I have to say we're kind of weird.
That would qualify in
you. Yeah, we are. I don't know how we became exotic pets. But so a group discussion that helps launch the learners into their week. And then if you think of a rocket into space as it's pursuing its mission, the next step for those learners is to do some independent work and some collaborative work. And so for teachers to bring about that kind of design, they've got to think about posting their content. And that's different from thinking that they need to be in Zoom delivering all of their content. If they can launch the learners through group discussion and then launch them into independent and collaborative work, then they have some time where they can be doing one-on-one check-ins. The devil's in the details. So the more that work is really well organized and well designed, if it's posted in an organized way on the platform, if students know exactly what they need to do to win the game that day, so like how are they going to be successful that day? How do they submit their work? What kind of points would they get? Can they see their progress? Is the length of those work sprints appropriate for the grade level? So to think that a kindergartner would have the stamina for a 75-minute work sprint is absolutely insane. We might be thinking in terms of maybe like an 8-minute work sprint, and right, then you return again for another group check-in. But starting to think about how does the teacher shift from being the person who's delivering synchronous instruction to instead being someone who posts that instruction, activates the learning, and then meets one-on-one with students. That's the real mindset shift that's underway in America right now.
So with that, you disclosed two ferrets and a bearded dragon. I'm going to make an assumption that there are some children in your house.
We have 5 children. So my oldest is 16 and a junior in high school. And then my youngest is 8 and he's in 3rd grade.
And are any of them in a online, you know, stay at home environment for school?
Well, interestingly, they all did remote for the first month. And then here in Texas, they've been back in a face-to-face with masks for a couple of weeks, but there has been a lot of flexibility shown from the school so if the student seems sick or isn't feeling well, the school doesn't want them to come. And so if a student shows up on Zoom instead, that's been perfectly acceptable. And I have to say that my hope and prayer right now is that the policymakers and the school leaders will think about retaining that flexibility, as we progress out of the pandemic. Just yesterday, my 11-year-old, I think, broke his wrist when he was playing flag football after school. And he's with his father right now getting his wrist checked out, which is why I was late for the podcast. But he was able to do his learning remotely today. And as a parent, how many of you parents have had days where your child, just for whatever reason, needs to not be in a physical classroom, but still should be learning? And it is another thing we can retire about our old system, is this idea that butts have to be in seats in order for it to qualify as an acceptable learning environment. We have got to move to a more flexible notion of, and you see that with the natural disasters and the other commotion in the world these days, families would be better served, and children, speaking of emotional and social needs, would be better served if there was a little less rigidity around how they learn, so long as they are learning.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, in certain parts of the country, you know, you probably never had a snow day in Southern California, but once you get a little further north, you know, learning gets disrupted frequently with, you know, or hurricanes or landslides or wildfires. You know, you see all those things on the news, but then you fail to recognize that it's disruptive, not only to the daily lives of everyone, but to the learning process. So tell me a little bit about, you know, in your text or other things that you're working on, what are some other disruptive innovations that can support this kind of dual modality that teachers and parents are working within right now?
What I've been describing in terms of this new way of thinking about the instructional model is what we call a flex model of blended learning. And the Christensen Institute and my research there we've designated that flex model as being highly disruptive. It doesn't look at all like the traditional classroom. Instead, it's a model that can toggle between face-to-face and remote learning, and it gives students much more control so that they have the right lesson at the right time in the right place for them. So that's one of the primary disruptive innovations I would point to, is that model itself. It's not just the online technology which enables that model, but it's the clarity that we're starting to get as a field around what are the core elements of that flex model and how could we assemble it together with some group discussion, some independent work, some collaborative work, the one-on-one check-ins, and then closing it out the learning block with another group discussion. And just that know-how is really what's changing the world. As you see the pods, the learning pods that are happening in backyards across America right now, as you see the co-ops and all of the variations right now. I just heard that 40% of children are enrolled in a different school this year than they were last year.
Wow.
That is in America, that is an amazing statistic. It means that this is such a ripe time for change and innovation. And because of that, we're loosening some of our constructs around what the classroom experience needs to be. And those disruptive innovations could serve us well if we, A, are continually innovating to solve the problems, to make sure it's equitable, to make sure that learners who have a variety of different gaps are able to get on the train. And then secondly, if we preserve that mentality once the pandemic is over.
So when you see what parents are going through on their end, you know, as a mother, what is your advice for the parents who are trying to balance and support their kids? Because that's one of the greatest struggles is, I'm going to work. I got a seventh grader, a third grader, and a ninth grader. They're all online. They're doing their different pieces, you know, and we've explored multiple times, like, you know, here's how you create that structure, the login time, the balance, et cetera. But what is some advice you have for parents as they're approaching, you know, this unknown of learning at the kitchen table?
Well, my heart kind of breaks for parents right now. It's a very difficult time for so many parents between juggling their work and having children at home and having often financial difficulties right now. It is truly a difficult time for parents. So one of my first recommendations is to try to take care of yourself. that what children need the very most is some amount of sanity and health for their caretaker. And so if we're so wrought with feeling that it has to be perfect for our children, that it compromises our ability to be whole and healthy for them, then that's probably not putting first things first. So I think there has been a return to this feeling that it's important to focus on our own physical and spiritual and mental wellness right now. As that's prioritized, then I do think there are some things parents can do. So as you're looking for the right program for your children, if they will be governing and driving their own learning for a lot of the school day, whether you have to be gone or you are there, but you're working and can't be right working with them, then it's wise to look for a program where there's a pretty engaged synchronous instructor, where there's someone who really is checking in with that learner and engaged with them. And if that means if your public school district is not doing that, or the teacher you were assigned is not doing that, then I do think advocating for that for your child will help them, or switching to a virtual school for the short term where they really prize themselves on more of that synchronous interaction. Those learners need it. The other thing that's happening rampantly is the development of pods. Now, not all families can organize a pod, and it takes some initiative, but what we're seeing is that for students that are in pods, the results look pretty promising right now. And that I think that cooperative, just working with other families in your neighborhood to try to work together. And I know just across the street, there's a pod in my neighborhood, and each family just takes one day a week. And that does alleviate the burden for those parents on the other days.
Right. So what advice do you have for systems to maintain a level of innovation and disruption? And I want to qualify that. So what I'm seeing a lot, and if this is not criticism, this is good people doing the fastest thing they can do to flip over. They're running their classrooms by just streaming the classroom. So one of the popular methods in a lot of states is kids come on Mondays and Thursdays, Tuesdays or Friday. Wednesday is a reset day where teachers are prepping, etc. But a lot of the systems, especially at the secondary level, are just streaming their classroom. And what we've explored today is, you know, checking in on them, differentiating that classroom lesson, making sure that that student has one-on-one contact and you're being put in there. But when we talk about the system, like the whole high school or the whole district, one of the things that I've been dealing with is, and coaching some of the systems, is this. They're giving assessments on their normal Thursday, or you know, the normal schedule of a Wednesday. There are everywhere. My tests are always on Wednesdays. Well, when the kids are out, when there's a child in the classroom on Mondays and Tuesdays, and then no children on Wednesdays, and then a separate group of kids goes Thursday, Friday, and now that other group is online, what's happening is there's a distinctive disadvantage for the child being assessed who wasn't in school on Mondays and Tuesdays and was in this format, a digital format, watching what's going on and not feeling safe asking questions or getting reinforcement. So when you think about systems and disruption in your research and work, what advice do you have for systems so that they can truly keep all the different students in the different modalities, you know, engaged to their best ability? I know that's a difficult question, but
No, it's very important. So I want to reiterate that there is a tendency right now to stream lessons synchronously and just be content with that. And I don't think it's even adequate. It's not even just that that we're missing opportunities. I think it's an inadequate solution, because we are baking into that so many assumptions around what's happening in those children's homes and the kind of support that they're getting to enable them to learn in that environment. So I hope that system leaders, and I do think they are, but I hope system leaders who are doing that streaming right now will wrestle with it and recognize that in the spring we were maybe handing out packets. Now at least we're streaming on Zoom. So that's a good, you know, we're moving, and this is all to be recognized and celebrated, but we got to keep moving. And no one would want to be in an online course where it's just streaming with poor visuals and poor interaction for very long. It's just not a good experience, and it's particularly for children. So one thing I've been working on recently is developing a set of micro-credentials that systems can use to help teachers start to master new competencies, because we do need those systemic solutions. And I think that at first that putting on the band-aids was really laudable. That was what we could do. But now system leaders are starting to say, how can we in a more systemic way start to develop new competencies? And the research that, we published a paper at the Christensen Institute called Developing a Student-Centered Workforce Through Micro-Credentials. This just came out on September 8th. And
a typical short title for
right? Well, I had to force them not to have a subtitle because it was getting so long. It'll turn into an acronym, don't worry. But Developing Student-Centered Workforce Through Micro-Credentials, and it's a paper that talks about how do we develop the workforce now so that it's more student-centered, it's more focused on addressing individual student needs, and the instructional model is shifting into that paradigm. So I think we'll see some innovations like micro-credentialing arise that help solve the PD issues that are really glaring right now for school districts.
So in your development of those micro-credentials, Heather, like, can you give us an example of like what would one of those micro-credentialed kind of programs focus on? Like, you know,
I'm sure.
Like your kids, you don't have a favorite, but if you were to have a favorite.
So I've written six so far, Ready to Blend is, which is my organization, we've authored six with Bloomboard. So Bloomboard is delivering the micro-credentials and we authored them. And the six packaged together into a micro-endorsement that teachers could get. In some places, we're hoping they'll actually be compensated as if they got a master's degree, that it's a way to get salary advancements. So the idea with micro-credentials is that it's an alternative certification program that could allow for more modularity in the way we think about PD solutions. So the six that are in there, one is called Assessing Individual Needs for Blended Learning. So it's the idea we just discussed. The second is called Designing a Weekly Blended Learning Arc. The third is about establishing norms. So how do you develop citizenship, digital citizenship norms and group discussion norms and so forth. The fourth is engaging parents to support blended learning. The fifth is onboarding students into a blended environment. So those are some of the micro credentials, and they would package together to help teachers have kind of an entry point of skills for thinking about leading their classrooms into this new way of teaching and learning. I don't want teachers to feel like it's completely overwhelming, but this set is designed to take about 15 weeks and it's embedded in the work you're already doing. So giving you small challenges to do each week to start shifting your practice towards a more blended learning arc type of model.
So I'm going to ask you to go a little deeper. Give us one of those challenges. Like, what's one strategy that we would find within those micro credentials that someone could immediately apply in their practices?
So for the designing a weekly blended learning arc, teachers to earn that micro credential need to demonstrate that they can lead a group discussion like we discussed.
Sure.
So they would need to just click record while they're doing their Zoom and show that they can lead a group discussion that allows students to collaborate as a community and equips them with a skill and inspires them to excellence, but isn't just streaming teacher-led direct instruction. Instead, it's leading a Socratic group discussion. So that's one example of a really concrete practice that teachers can learn and then use in their toolkit as they're going through a week of blended learning.
So before we're done here, what are other ways? So micro-credentialing, what are some other things that people, resources or tools that you have that people could use to engage themselves in their own personal and professional development so they can support kids in better ways? This is your soft opportunity to.
Well, I have to be honest with you. So in 2015, Michael Horn and I co-authored the book Blended, Using Disruptive Innovation to Improve Schools. And it has experienced a resurgence recently. And also I've had a resurgence of speaking requests and training requests. And I do think that there can be value in the speaking and training. I love doing it. I think it's fun to lead a seminar. But I will say that the disadvantage is that too often we have resorted to professional development solutions in the past that are sit and get instruction. And where a school leader doesn't know specifically that the teachers that they find substitutes for and go through finding the time to for that event, they don't know for sure that those teachers will actually have the skills that they need when school starts again on Monday. And that's what led me to want to do this work, to say, what is a more modular solution? The classic example of modularity is a light bulb that you can reliably twist into a lamp socket. And you can go to Target or Walmart and buy a light bulb and know that it'll twist into that lamp socket. We school leaders need something similar, where you know that a certain PD module will give you the specific skills you need for that third grade ELA block, right, or whatever it is. And so in my mind, this is one of those disruptive innovations that we've discussed that could allow for modularity for school leaders, so that you have a more specified, verifiable, and predictable way of ordering up the PD that you need. That's why I've shifted to really focusing on micro-credentials right now instead of events and workshops.
Well, and just like you said before, I mean, the immediate ability to apply, experiment, fail fast, learn quick, you know, with the kids is really, really going to be important. Right. Well, Heather, this has been fun. I mean, from everything from, you know, your time with the governor, with Governor Wilson, all the way to, you know, where you're at today and a true recognized thought leader in blended learning approaches. And I've read your text and I looked at all your materials. And I highly recommend, you know, our listeners do the same, because it will inspire you to approach this digital interruption that many people see as more of a digital innovation. So thank you for your time today. This was wonderful, and I wish you well in the future.
Thank you, Ted. It was great to talk to you.
So let's do some smart thinking. Describe what it means to mind the gaps. List ways in which you can build relationships with students to support the blended learning environments. And what is a flex model of learning? That's it. That's the Smart Thinking Podcast. Hey, as always, thank you for listening, and please make sure to share and rate this episode on your social media platform. And as we move forward here with the learning from Heather, keep a couple of things in mind. It's not easy to pivot and shift to a blended learning environment. It's not easy on the parents, the kids, the teachers, the staff, the school, the community. And any little tip and trick you can pull from this and employ to increase the engagement of kids, support their relationships, and make them better learners will be helpful. Take these little tidbits, great ideas, interventions, innovations, and strategies, and do your best with them. And, like always, be Buffalo.